This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thanks for your company. We've had a few good years of rain in Queensland across parts. This season's crop is looking pretty good, but that does bring with it some problems, like potentially an increase in pests, especially if breeding conditions are ideal and there's plenty of food around. Farmers are being urged to monitor for mice during this harvest as the threat of a big increase in the pest population looms. Have you seen any at your place? You can send me a text on 0487 993 222. So trapping by the chief science agency, CSIRO, has revealed much higher than usual numbers of pregnant females in key cropping zones. Steve Henry is the research officer, and he tells Angus Furley that farmers need to get a sense of numbers now so they are prepared to act at sowing time in autumn next year.
We've just completed our spring monitoring run through most of the cropping zone. And while there are quite a few places where there are low or almost no signs of mouse activity, there are a couple of places where we were a bit concerned about what we were seeing. So certainly on the Adelaide Plains, where we had much higher trap success than we normally have at this time of the year, and all of the females that we caught during our trapping sessions showed signs of reproduction, that was a zone where we were quite concerned. But also areas like the Wimmera in Victoria, and to a lesser extent, some of the places in northern New South Wales, southern Queensland, the Darling Downs, for instance. At the moment, we're not seeing very much activity there, but that doesn't mean that they're not there. So we're really advocating that people take a watching brief as we go forward to harvest and then into the stubble.
And for those areas, particularly northern New South Wales, southern Queensland, bumper crop, heavy stubble loads, I suppose there could be a lot of feed over that summer period for those mice.
Yeah, absolutely. And barley's one of those crops that's a real alarm for us because it is a big crop. We see some really big yields, 5 and 6 tonne yields that do leave a fair amount of grain behind, either because of wind abundance prior to harvest or just simply processing such big crops, lots of biomass. So all of those things add up to really good environment for mice. So lots of biomass left behind, lots of cover for mice, but also lots of grain in amongst all of that shelter, so ideal conditions.
So just taking a step back with that, those really high pregnancy and reproductive numbers, what does that mean looking forward to the autumn time when mice can be most problematic?
If we get an average or even better, slightly better than average harvest and a wet summer, that provides a scenario where mice could potentially keep to breeding through the stubble phase and be there in high numbers when we're sowing the next crop next April. So really important to manage the stubble phase, know what's going on there and be prepared to take action if we start to see high numbers.
So at this time of the year, it's about monitoring and getting a sense of numbers rather than actually going out and baiting?
Yeah, I think that we're so close to harvest now that we probably won't see the kind of numbers in the current crop that will cause significant damage at harvest. It's more about, you know, being prepared to take action as we see numbers increase in the stubble.
And it might be hard to talk in general terms, but what is generally best practice when it comes to baiting regimes around sowing time in the autumn?
Yeah, so we know, you know, we would like farmers to have access to the 50 gram bait, but we don't. So what we do know about the current bait strength is that it's way more effective if there's less food in the system. So it's a bit like it's almost common sense. The less other food that you have in the system, that gives mice the best chance of discovering the 2 or 3 grains that they need to get a lethal dose. So harvesting as clean as possible is critically important. If you've got sheep as part of your system, use them to graze the stubbles to reduce the background food for mice. And then bait as you're sowing the next crop, because the act of sowing the crop actually buries a lot of that residual food, and then that gives mice the best chance of finding those grains as you, if you've spread them as you're sowing the crop. When they pop up after the crop's sown, all the other food's been buried, the first thing they find is those baits on the surface. It's really important for them to get out, have a look, work out what the situation is, and it's pretty easy to do in a stubble. You can walk a couple of hundred metres and count all the burrows, active burrows in that 100 metre strips, and then multiply up to burrows per hectare, and that'll give you a really quick rule of thumb about how many mice you have. So if you've got one burrow per 100 square metres, that's 100 burrows per hectare, and if there's about two mice per burrow, then that's not an unreasonable assumption. Then we know then you've got 200 mice per hectare. That's the time to start taking action.
So, Steve, you're issuing a word of warning, but you're not using terms like potential plague.
No, we're not, and we're always a bit reluctant to do that. We don't want to take an alarmist approach, but what we want to say to farmers is that there's a whole lot of factors that are starting to stack up together that we should be really starting to be on a higher alert than normal. So be prepared, get out, have a look, know what's going on in your stubbles, and be prepared to take action.
And your approach or your level of caution, does that come down a bit to lived experience? If say, for example, in relatively recent times you went through the New South Wales plague, have you perhaps got that fresh in your mind and you're more on alert than someone who maybe hasn't experienced a plague for a long time?
I think that that's a really valid approach. I mean, what happened in New South Wales is, you know, they hadn't had a plague for about 10 years. And at the point where they're saying, oh, gee, I'm seeing a few mice, but they're probably not much to worry about, the point at which they're seeing a few mice is the time to start to take action. We know that mice breed so quickly that, you know, if you've got 100 mice per hectare and 50 of those are females and they're having 6 to 10 babies every 19 to 21 days, it doesn't take very long to go from, gee, I'm seeing a few mice, to, man, I'm overrun by mice. I guess the only other thing to say is that it doesn't take very much food to feed a lot of mice. So 150 kilos per hectare left behind after the harvest is the equivalent of 50,000 mouse days. So, yeah, I hear stories of a whole lot more food than that, but if you've only got 150 kilos per hectare, that's enough to feed 1,000 mice per hectare through 50 days of summer.
Steve Henry is the research officer with CSIRO. Now, if you've got any advice on dealing with mice, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. That might be able to be something that you can share ahead of this, you know, potential for this population outbreak. Well, as Steve mentioned earlier, the double-strength mouse bait is not currently available, but Grain Producers Australia is pushing for it to be re-registered amid big increases in the pest numbers in parts of the country's cropping zones. Now, the ZP50 bait was approved for emergency use by the chemicals regulator during the last mouse plague in New South Wales, but that approval lapsed 2 years ago. Andrew Wiedemann is the research and development spokesperson for GPA and says grain growers need access to the more lethal bait.
We've been acutely aware through our colleagues in Queensland, northern New South Wales, of a potential emerging mouse plague on the back, of course, of some exceptional growing season conditions for those growers up there, Angus. And we've been working and resubmitted the emergency permit for ZP50. We've also inserted some new information, obviously, that's come since the lapse of the permit some 2 years ago. We're in the process and been working acutely with the regulator to look at how we can maybe get that emergency permit lifted up again to help the farmers in particular that area, but also become available more broadly if needed in other areas of Australia on the back of, you know, some of the most promising rains I suppose we've seen in a while here in the Wimmera again, Angus.
I know you're seeking another emergency approval, but do you need to get ongoing permanent approval?
Well, look, ultimately that will be the aim of the industry, to certainly go forward and have it registered fully, so we don't need to use permits to obviously facilitate the availability of the product. But at the moment, we're still a long way short of actually getting that over the line. And I suppose really on the back of what we heard from growers many years ago now, it seems about the aversion to certainly the Z25 product, which still works most definitely in areas where there's not a lot of food and source of available on the ground, Angus, and that's been what we've found, is that essentially that you needed more than one grain, you needed at least two grains with the product on it to actually kill a mouse. And if they get enough other food source around them, then they obviously are foraging for that as well at the same time. So that's where the research has been really crucial, led by Steve Henry and the team from CSIRO, and a lot of growers that are listening will obviously have been and listened to Steve at some of the grower updates that have been run throughout the country. So I think it's really important that, you know, we as an industry take these steps.
And as you said there, researchers from CSIRO have done the scientific work, haven't they, verifying the anecdote that if a mouse eats one grain of bait, of that regular strength bait, it won't kill it typically, and it can develop an aversion to it, and then it won't go and find another bait to deliver a lethal dose.
Yeah, exactly. And you end up with colonies, essentially. I mean, I've experienced it here on my own farm. I had one paddock in particular that was always a problem with mice, and it was clear that there was too much food available when we were baiting. And one pass of the 50, I've actually wiped that colony out.
So you're talking with the APVMA. What feedback have you had so far?
Yeah, so look, we've obviously had the permit in place. It takes at least 120 days from the start of that process. In between that, we've had some questions to answer in terms of some of the research work that we've provided. Whether or not we'll get that permit up, that's, you know, debatable at the moment, because clearly we need to provide as much data as we can, and we're building that data through the industry work through Chris Lestier in terms of the mammal and bird data for Australia. And I think that's something that a lot of farmers will become well aware, with other products like Paraquat and Diaquat, that the research work we need to underpin the long-term survival of a lot of the products we're using, but also, you know, when we look forward at some of the other products that are going to come to market, to make sure that we've actually got the anecdotal data that will actually match and allow our regulator to give a green light to some of these products.
And I'll put this to the regulator, but is that their concern, that this double strength bait would have those off-target impacts on native animals other than mice?
Well, look, we didn't have enough data, I suppose, to support the regulator's view at the time, Angus, and that's why it's been important that we build that information over time, and also, you know, verifying more of the research work that we've just spoken about in terms of the capacity for the product to work better and more efficacious than the 25. Look, growers, once they've experienced using the Z50, now they're all asking for it. And so, anecdotally, growers are the litmus test of a product in any shape or form, Angus, as to the way that it works and the efficacious ability of these products to do a timely job and remove what has become, unfortunately, you know, in our no-till and conservation agriculture, one of the bigger pest issues that we face.
In an age of greater environmental awareness, is it getting more difficult to get new products approved?
Well, look, it is without the work. I mean, that's why, look, Australia's climate, we're so different to the rest of the world, where a lot of the regulatory bodies around the world probably look at Australia with a different view because of our actual nature of our climate systems. And that's where we didn't have the work done here in Australia. And that's what is being the investments now that are being made on behalf of industry to try and make sure that we do have that data and continuing to look at what else can be done in terms of informing and training people in the use of products as well into the future. And not just mouse bait products, we're also talking about crop protection products in terms of seed dressings and other things, Angus. So there are other things in the pipeline that we need to make sure that the research actually supports and underpins here in Australia.
Andrew Wiedemann is the R&D spokesperson for Grain Producers Australia, speaking there with Angus Furley. Now, in a statement, the chemicals regulator, the APVMA, a spokesperson has said that they can confirm that the evaluation of the GPA permit application is underway. And they said that emergency permits are issued to legalise the use of an AgVet chemical product to address an emergency situation. When there is no emergency, the APVMA has other pathways to legalise the use of products. They said that The process does not involve changing the status of an emergency permit to permanent, and that the duration of an emergency use permit will correspond with the time required to meet the need associated with the emergency. It is 20 minutes past 12. Up next, you'll hear from Queensland's Primary Industries Minister on a return from a trip to Indonesia.
Before the sun rises, your local ABC team are starting their day getting ready to help you start yours. We're here to inform you as to what's happening with local news and events. ABC Breakfast, weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Queensland's Primary Industries Minister has recently returned from taking a trade delegation of business people to Indonesia. And he says he's confident of building on booming beef, dairy and horticulture exports. So last financial year, live cattle exports from Northern Australia to Indonesia rose by 32% to more than 561,000 head. And that represents about 72% of Australia's live cattle exports. So Tony Perrott tells Jennifer Nichols that with a population of more than 283 million people, there's serious potential for growth.
They're extremely important, as we know, for live export. And I was able to visit two feedlots while I was in Indonesia and just see Queensland bred cattle being fed in Indonesian conditions. And yeah, the market requirements that they're feeding for and the opportunities that exist to be able to strengthen that important trade for Queensland beef producers. And I was very pleased to see how they're kept in the feedlots, how they're fed, the timeframes, the weight gains. Very impressive. And linking into then the further opportunities, particularly live export, but also in the area of chilled and frozen beef, some of the top end markets that we can now supply beef into and the opportunities there to be able to grow our interests into Indonesia.
It's always a delicate subject, but there have been issues raised in the past about the treatment of animals when they're being slaughtered in Indonesia. Did you broach that subject while you were there?
Yeah, look, there was certainly an issue that they're cognizant of, and there's been changes to the slaughter methods, of course. The way they slaughter animals was, you know, different many, many years ago, but, you know, and particularly around the halal certification. But they've certainly, you know, with the aid of Queenslanders and, you know, Australian methods, have been able to reform that. And that was always the key. That was extremely disappointing back in 2011 that there was a knee-jerk reaction by the then federal Labor government to cease live exports to Indonesia. And that, of course, created an enormous amount of financial and emotional difficulty for a lot of Queensland beef producers, but particularly for the Indonesians. And I heard it time and time again while I was there. It's about food security for their people. And of course, having us involved through the whole supply chain and being able to work with them to be able to improve methods certainly has been advantageous. Something that I absolutely support. And what I observe there, particularly in the feedlots, you know, feedlots that contain many thousands of head of cattle that are all in shelter, are fed very similarly in pens and bunkers. The cattle were all, you know, very contented, were doing well, you know, up to 2 kilos of weight gain per day. So, yeah, was very impressed with the way they've, you know, adopted improved practices.
Now, where are the live exports going out at this stage from Queensland?
Townsville. Of course, there's the cattle that also go out of the Northern Territory. And that's an important trade. It's many thousands of cattle head out, you know, on a monthly basis out of Queensland into Indonesia and into the various feedlots that they have there. And high Brahman content cattle, although there were certainly some, you know, crossbred cattle that were there as well. So very impressed. And then when I, you know, with the chilled and frozen beef, a lot of that beef's coming out of Queensland abattoirs from Queensland bred cattle, and it was at the top end of quality. Obviously, you know, the price is somewhat higher than the feedlot cattle that go into perhaps some different markets. But talking to one beef importer, he's investing into further chilled capacity to be able to store Queensland beef and wants to, you know, grow that market there. So there's a real opportunity to not only just maintain what we have, but more importantly, grow it.
What are the figures at the moment in terms of export?
About 500,000 head of cattle end up into Indonesia on an annual basis, and that can vary. There's always challenges that sit around that, seasonal conditions, and we'll be able to ship them there and various things. But the husbandry, the health checks, the veterinary practices that we have in place to make certain that those cattle are shipped there in a good state. I saw cattle in one of the feedlots that had only been there for a week, and they were, you know, very, very healthy. They'd travelled well. They'd taken to the feed very quickly. And in most cases, you know, some of those, you know, the maximum time, similar to what we have in our feedlots, 90 to 100 days and the cattle are out. So very, very impressed with the work that's going on.
Is that 500,000 from Queensland or is that 500,000 from Australia?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And some of those cattle that go from the Northern Territory may have come from Queensland, but predominantly they go from Townsville.
Okay. And also there's the dairy cattle export program because the president has vowed to give free lunches and milk to all school students.
Absolutely. In one of the feedlots, we saw about 50 Friesian dairy cows that had been sourced from Australia. They were in full milk production. Again, those cattle were contented. They were, you know, in high production. And there's significant opportunity to be able to grow that, given the Indonesian president, as you mentioned, has indicated that he wants to see more milk into particularly their younger people in their school children. And when you remember that they're the fourth most populous nation in the world, over 280 million people. So, you know, a slight increase in their consumption of a certain Queensland or Australian product gives us enormous opportunity to be able to export into those areas. And I know that there's a shipment of Queensland dairy cows that are just being prepared. They're coming out of southern Queensland from a dairy farm in southern Queensland, Brown Swiss. I understand that they're being prepared for export in the Northern Territory up at Darwin to go to Indonesia in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
And it really is an issue of nutrition in Indonesia with childhood stunting and malnutrition.
They spoke about that when I was there and the opportunities, and particularly given that the president's indicated that he wants to lift the nutritional value that's given to children. And you can see that. Look, you look at the, you know, obviously about 15% of their population is middle to high income earners. And I was able to visit various shopping malls and particularly Ranch Market where I was able to host a Taste of Queensland promotional event. And it wasn't just quality Australian beef products that I saw in that supermarket. There was also horticultural products. There was honey, macadamias. There was Bundaberg brewed drinks. So there's also opportunity into other commodities.
Queensland Primary Industries Minister Tony Perrott speaking there to Jennifer Nichols.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. My name is Megan Hughes. Dave has texted in and about my earlier story on the number of mice around at the moment, and there's sort of, you know, potential for a bit of a population boom, especially in that sort of southern Queensland, northern New South Wales area. Dave has said that an organic way of getting rid of mice is to mix icing sugar and cement powder. He said the important part is a bowl of water. And he uses this around his house and sheds where his animals are. Thank you, Dave, for that text message and that advice. If you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour today, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. So do you have any advice on how to deal with mice, the most effective way to bait maybe, or other alternative methods that you use for trapping? Or have you ever dealt with a mice plague before? Maybe that's some advice about how to keep them out of your house. But for now, I'll take you to central Queensland, to Brigalow country in particular. It's in the spotlight, and that's thanks to $9.6 million in state funding for the Fitzroy Basin Association. State Natural Resources Minister Dale Last explains what it's for.
We made a $117 million commitment at the election, and so we're rolling that funding out to all the NRM groups across Queensland. They obviously had to put forward their proposals. Those proposals were considered and assessed, and now that funding has rolled out to these groups. Some of the groups have already started this work, but it certainly makes a huge difference. A lot of them rely on volunteers to do their work, and this certainly supports them in the work that they do. It's a real collaboration between these NRM groups, the local communities, industry stakeholders like the Ag Force and NFF, local councils and the Queensland Government.
So the Fitzroy Basin Association, $200,000 of that funding is going to be dedicated to protecting critical turtle nesting sites. But the bulk of the money is going to target 17,000 hectares of Brigalow country. CEO Elise Reith-Muller tells Claudia Sullivan that the funding is for land management, soil resilience and vegetation restoration.
Brigalow is a very large bioregion or a ecosystem across, goes from northern New South Wales all the way north to in behind the reef here. And it's had a long history, so there was schemes in the turn of the century for Brigalow clearing. It's a nitrogen-producing tree, so everyone, when you clear that country, you get a really great grass production for the first while, and then your pastures, that soil nitrogen is deleted, so it's not as productive. And then on top of that, your Brigalow comes back, and it comes back really thick, and then it outcompetes the grass, and so then you don't have any grass. So our graziers have been having this ongoing struggle where you clear it, which costs money to clear it, you get some great production of grass for a while, then it starts to come back, and then you, the amount of grass you have left in your paddocks declines. So one of the things we've been looking at is how do we get that balance? How do we get a good balance of some trees, great grass production, graziers that can actually be making money out of that and managing it. And then there's a whole large community of animals like yucca skinks and ornamental snakes that are believed to be threatened but actually live in those landscapes and rely on all the plants that are in the Brigalow community. So this funding that was announced today is very much for on-ground action. So it'll support us to work directly with land managers and funding to those land managers to actually do some of the things they're really keen to do.
What might some of those things be?
Yeah, oh, look, it can be arranged. So some of the things could be around different approaches to thinning Brigalow so that you can get some more mature Brigalow, so you get grass, you also... other programs we might be looking at how we create some habitat for those yucca skinks, ornamental snakes, those kinds of animals that like to live in the cracks in the black soil. Managing grazing pressure, we've also got another program. So we say Brigalow, but there's a whole range of different vegetation that lives in that broad Brigalow landscape. And one is king bluegrass, which is what I think people call the ice cream for cattle, when it's that really palatable, great grass and cows will search it out, but it's also threatened. So how do we actually support landholders to still be able to graze it because the grass actually can cope well with grazing, but then take that pressure out? So it could be fencing so that they can manage when the stock are in that paddock and when they're not. So what we did with putting this program together is we're looking at soils, we're looking at ground cover, so your grass, we're looking at king bluegrass. We've also got a component of the work that will be focusing in on koala habitat and supporting landholders to fast track the weed removal in those larger stands of koala habitat. The reason we focus in on that work is it's often lantana, and lantana burns hot. So not only is it scratchy, not something a koala wants to climb, crawl through to get up a tree, but it also burns really hot. So when you get those uncontrolled fires and you get heat, it can actually really kill the food trees for koalas and the habitat trees. So we're working with landholders up around the Clark Connors Range as well. That's quite a hot spot for koalas. And then a program that we will have put out a media release today about, which is calling on our broadacre farmers across the region who would like to do something with an area of their paddock where their soil health or soil resilience is declining, then it's not as productive, to nominate those places and we can work with them to maybe do cover cropping or how we can get more organic matter back into that soil, which helps it to have all the microbes that break down all the nutrients that make it available for the crops that they're growing, that it holds water more effectively, get a more productive crop.
Fitzroy Basin Association CEO Elise Reith-Muller. It is after 12:30, which means weather's up next.
What's complicated, brilliant, and has over 200 years of rollicking backstory? Our Australian electoral system. Join Annabelle Crabb to investigate.
Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty starts Monday, November 10 on ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's time to check in on the weather, and Harry Clark joins me from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Harry.
Good afternoon, Megan.
So, the stable conditions continuing for much longer in Queensland?
Yeah, so a few days to come yet. We have seen much more dry air move across the majority of the state in the last 24 hours, bring clear skies for most, and also a fairly cool morning as well in comparison to recent days. We did see Stanthorpe getting down to around 5 degrees this morning, and a few other single-digit minimums across the southern interior as well. So quite a contrast to the last week. The only place in the state that is seeing a little bit of shower and thunderstorm activity is eastern districts north around Rockhampton. So some very isolated afternoon shower and thunderstorms expected right up the coast into the far north and across the peninsula once again this afternoon. Not dropping huge rainfall totals. We did see one isolated total of around 60 millimetres at Daintree Village in the 24 hours, 9 this morning. The next best further south, much further south, at Callide Dam, around 22 millimetres yesterday afternoon with isolated showers and thunderstorms. But really, that will be the story for today and tomorrow. Just isolated showers on the east coast around north around Rockhampton, but remaining sunny elsewhere across the state.
So what does this mean for temperatures?
Yeah, so in terms of our temperatures, generally below average for most locations, particularly through the interior and far west, down the east coast as well, thanks to those relatively cool south-southeasterly winds we have present at the moment. So we will see maximum temperatures pretty much in the low 30s throughout the interior today, or even the first sort of very high 20s through places like the Darling Downs. As we go into tomorrow, we do see things start to warm up a little bit, and indeed much further on Friday. So our temperatures will be on an increasing trend as we go towards Friday. If we pick on, say, Boulia, for example, going for around 30 degrees today, 35 degrees tomorrow, and up to 40 degrees by Friday. It's all thanks to the next trough system that will start to bring a more northerly wind flow through the interior as we head into the latter part of the week, and with that temperatures increasing. In eastern districts, we are seeing temperatures much more stable. Generally, we will see a bit of a return of humidity over the next few days as our wind flow switches to be more southeasterly, those temperatures remaining relatively close to the November average in the east. And the exception is, once again, the far north. We still have some severe heatwave conditions continuing around parts of the peninsula, with really that cooler air mass failing to make it into the peninsula. There's maximum temperatures sitting at or close to 40 degrees for many locations.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the latest on the heat wave. Does it look like it'll start to cool down by Friday?
Look, not a huge amount. It'll probably sit around where it's staying at the moment. So we do see, for example, Weipa sitting at maximum temperature forecasts of 38 degrees right throughout the coming week. On the North Tropical Coast, we will see a very slight reprieve as our southeasterly winds start to increase a little bit over coming days, but still those temperatures only knocking down a degree or two with that increase in southeasterly winds. So for the far north, not a huge amount of change in that sort of heat. It really is quite stagnant air mass across that region.
Now, in the interior, so northwest, central highlands, coalfields, northern goldfields and upper Flinders and the Gulf Country, there's some high fire dangers through those regions. What's driving that?
Yeah, it's really a combination of, I guess, relatively dry air that's around today, so quite low relative humidities. Indeed, our dew points, which is our preferred measure of humidity, is actually negative for much of the interior today, hence those high fire dangers for those districts. As we go into tomorrow, we do start to see a little bit of a return of moisture for most locations. So only districts with high fire danger tomorrow are the Central Highlands and Coalfields and the Gulf Country. But as I mentioned, as we go towards Friday, our winds swing around to the north, our temperatures increase, and so do our winds, particularly through the interior. So we will see high fire dangers returning to virtually the entire interior tomorrow and also parts of the central Queensland coast and the Gulf Country as well.
Yeah, and when you sort of talk about that change in wind direction, what does that mean for our coastal waters?
Yeah, so for the next few days in our coastal waters, we do have southeasterly winds pretty much re-establishing themselves today. Generally quite light, 10 to 15 knots for the majority of the coastline up and down the Queensland coast today. We do see the Gulf being a little bit stronger, up to 15 to 20 knots today. As we head into tomorrow, we do see our central and northern waters increase up to 15 to 20 knots as that ridge of high pressure slowly strengthens, remaining around that 10 to 15 knot mark in the southeast, and pretty similar conditions expected on Friday. So I guess east-southeasterly wind is going to be dominating as we head into the remainder of the week, and probably turning a little bit more northeasterly as we get towards the weekend and that trough approaches.
And looking into next week, are these stable conditions continuing, or is it more likely we'll see troughs again or anything else?
Yeah. Mm. So as we head into Friday, we do see that next trough approach the Channel Country and Maranoa and Warrego from the west. And with that, we see a return of some thunderstorms for those districts. Will be quite isolated, not a huge amount of rainfall with them, but some potential for some gusty winds, even possibly some damaging wind gusts with those storms on Friday. And as we go into Saturday, we see that trough progress further into Queensland. So a broad band of thunderstorms expected to stretch from the Gulf Country through the northwest, central west, and indeed into the Maranoa, Warrego, Darling Downs, and even far western parts of the southeast coast. Will be hit and miss in nature and not as widespread as we saw last weekend. There is a potential that some of those thunderstorms could be severe about the southern downs, parts of the Maranoa, Warrego as well. And on Sunday, that system will progress eastwards to be stretching really through much of eastern Queensland. And on Sunday, it does link up with a little bit more moisture, so we do start seeing the rainfall chances increase, particularly around that sort of Wide Bay, Burnett, Capricornia, and Central Highlands and Coalfields region, around that sort of 10 to 15 millimetre mark, fairly widespread at this stage, potentially more if we do get some thunderstorms in the mix as well. So not a hugely intense system coming through over the weekend, but definitely our next significant one, and looking into early next week, probably going to be lingering in the east on Monday before we get our next ridge start to establish itself on Tuesday, really returning settled conditions to much of Queensland.
Harry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Harry Clark, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. Now, local fire bans remain in place for 7 council areas across parts of North Queensland today. During fire bans, you're not allowed to light any fire in the open, but some exceptions do apply. There are more details about what you can and can't do during a fire ban and a full list of the council areas that have bans in place today at the Queensland Fire Department website. You can head to fire.qld.gov.au. That is fire.qld.gov.au.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It is 18 minutes to 1. The Freight and Trade Alliance is calling for federal law reform to rein in skyrocketing import and export charges at the nation's ports. So on Friday, 4 stevedoring companies, and they unload and load the cargo, announced the fees they charge importers and exporters would increase between 5 and 15% year on year, and a 47% increase in one particular case. Paul Zale is the director at FTA, and he's the secretariat for the Australian Peak Shippers Association. He says fee increases are out of control.
They announced increases, which isn't unusual. The stevedores over the last decade have been introduced a fee on transport operators, and that fee started as a few dollars per container and is now well over a couple of hundred dollars per container with the latest increases. So a big hit for Australian exporters and importers, on top of other supply chain costs, 5 to 15%, but in WA even more so. So DP World, Dubai Ports, that run the stevedore operations around the country, they got the largest increase in Fremantle, up to about 47% on imports and exports.
Why such a discrepancy between most increases being 5 to 15 and that at one company at one port being 47?
Yeah, I suppose they're playing catch up. Traditionally, the fees in the West have been a lot cheaper than the East Coast, mainly controlled by the government over there. The port is a government owned asset, unlike on the East Coast, which have been privatised. And the government, up until this latest increase, really had done a pretty good job to keep a lid on the pricing over there. But looks as though the genie's out of the bottle there as well.
And generally, I'm reading a quote from you where you summarise your view on these charges across the country, and you say it's the Wild West out there with an anything-goes mentality on our waterfront.
Yeah, so just to give it a bit of context, so the stevedores are the entities that load and unload containers off the ships that they come into the country, so, you know, handling all our import and exports. Their commercial customer, the one they're contracted to, are the foreign-owned shipping lines that service Australia. Those shipping lines are in a pretty strong position, and we've got, as you indicated, you know, quite a few stevedore operations in Australia. So rather than putting up their prices to the shipping lines, they're actually keeping a lid on that those costs there, but they've found another source of income. They hit the transport operator, whether that be road or rail, that have no ability to influence service or price, and put these exorbitant fees on them. Now, the ACCC do a stevedore monitoring report each year, and using their own words last year at their, when they did the report, they referred to it as a market failure and requiring some form of government intervention, which to date we haven't seen. And, you know, we're seeing the results. You know, we hear inflation hasn't gone away. And you just look at your supply chain, you know, that brings in everything for housing, food, you name it. And that's where one of the sources of inflation is happening.
Okay, so then does that mean that on the import side that costs of consumer goods become more expensive, and on the export side, whether that's agricultural commodities or others, that the price that producers receive for that those goods essentially becomes less?
Yeah, look, you're spot on. And again, so it really affects any commodity that's high volume and low value. So you look at your grain exports and items like that that do move in containers. Every time there's an increase of the rates, so that diminishes their profits and adds a significant amount per ton on their export price, and really affects Australia's competitiveness for our exports. You know, we've been pushing very hard for some form of regulation to bring an end to this, either a mandatory code with some oversight from the competition regulator, or better still, some regulation that stops the fees being imposed on the transport operators and forces the stevedore then to negotiate with their commercial customer, the shipping line. If the shipping line isn't in a position to absorb those costs, well, then they can pass it on in negotiated freight rates with importers, exporters and freight forwarders. And that's how we believe commerce should work.
So you're very explicitly calling on the Albanese government to bring in new legislation?
At minimum, they need to introduce a mandatory code, something that's been recommended by the Productivity Commission. But we would even suggest they go further. And, you know, I think a mandatory code still has a high level of complexity. If they would regulate that the stevedores must charge their commercial customer, they could stand away from the rest of it and just let commercial pressures look after the rest of pricing.
That was Paul Zale, the director at the Freight and Trade Alliance and the secretariat for the Australian Peak Shippers Association, speaking with Angus Furley. Infrastructure and Transport Minister Catherine King said in a statement that the facilitators of our country's import and export gateways to the world, large cost increases from stevedores are concerning. She said that's why we're working with transport ministers in every state and Northern Territory to take action. And on the 11th of August, Transport Ministers meeting, we endorsed the National Transport Commission to update the National Voluntary Guidelines for Landside Stevedore Charges to include a requirement for stevedore operators to implement their price changes on the 1st of January rather than throughout the year. Transport ministers across the country have also agreed to include empty container park operators in the guidelines with similar requirements as stevedore operators.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Before I take you to the markets, I want to introduce you to a champion cutting horse trainer who thought she would never ride again after a devastating multiple sclerosis diagnosis. But 7 years down the road, Linda McCallum is still in the saddle and credits her horses for saving her future. She shares her remarkable story with Lara Webster.
I grew up mustering in the Great Dividing Range with my dad. Big days on very much station horses, you know, nothing of recognisable breeding. But I would go with my dad all day and spend big days in the hills.
Today, Linda's won significant events, trains horses for a loyal clientele base and represented Australia twice in the USA. She's also been inducted into the Non-Pro Hall of Fame. But in 2018, the sport and the horses she loves became significant in Linda's life for another reason.
I was sitting there and I can never forget, I had a funny feeling in my throat and I thought that I had eaten a different chewing gum that my son had given me. He was about 12 at the time. And he'd given me some different chewing gum. And I thought that I was having a bit of a reaction to the different chewing gum. I felt like my throat swelled up. It's almost like I felt like I was having a bit of an anaphylactic reaction.
At that point, significant illness was ruled out. But after stroke-like symptoms occurred a few weeks later, Linda was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, a chronic autoimmune disease that affects the central nervous system.
The future that I had planned or I expected for myself and my family was completely rearranged. And at the time, I didn't know if I would have a very progressive form of MS where I may not be able to function very well in the few years to come.
She was told she would never ride again.
I was laying there in recovery and I was crying and I said, I've got a futurity event in 2 weeks. And that's when the surgeon said, darling, you're not going to ride again. And that really hit me. So in that moment, you know, your world comes crashing down.
But some words from her husband, Jim, had a profound impact.
I'll never forget, Jim said to me, he said, if you think you can ride at that event, you should, because you don't know what the future holds. And he said, you've been sent a horse for a reason right now. I said, what do you mean? He said, Metallic Storm, think of his initials. So every time, you know, it does make me quite emotional because I do believe that horse saved me in that moment.
Just weeks after her diagnosis, Linda rode Metallic Storm. She didn't just ride, she won.
I won the Classic Challenge and I placed in everything else and I was reserve champion in the Open Futurity as an amateur rider. So we came away with $80,000 in prize money and to be in the Non-Pro Hall of Fame. In the NCHA, you have to win $75,000. So I essentially went from, you know, into the Non-Pro Hall of Fame in one event as an amateur rider. So it was an incredible show.
That day is the one Linda believes saved her life in the saddle, a saving grace led by Metallic Storm.
That horse, I do believe, carried me at that event, and all the horses did. And I think it says so much for what that event did for me in my future, because I don't know if I hadn't ridden there, would I still be riding now? I'm not sure.
7 years down the road since her diagnosis, Linda McCallum is still riding and training, but she's now also a wellness coach. And that's because she wants to share her journey as far and wide as possible and help people recovering from trauma and adversity reconnect with horses and get back in the saddle. And that mission is taking her across Australia and even internationally.
Like, everything that you're doing right there is exactly what I'd be doing. Everyone suffers in their life some form of adversity. So that's often what happens. And people come and they may have left horse riding to have a family, or they've suffered, you know, some trauma, or they just want some confidence to get back in the arena. And when I can get out in that arena, in our industry, which is quite male-dominated in the professional area, you know, when I can compete in that arena, I guess it gives people something to look to.
She runs regular clinics across the nation.
So we're just going to meet every horse where they're at.
It isn't just about the horses. There's also a significant focus on the well-being of those riding them.
Often we start over a cup of coffee and we'll talk about our life story. We will share you know, where we've come to, and people have shared incredible parts of themselves in that moment. At the very beginning, we talk about a lot of things about mindset. I have a lot of metaphors for life that come from my horse training that relate as well in clinics on an everyday basis. So it is something that I found is so unique. I love it, being able to connect with people on that level.
That was New England cutting horse trainer Linda McCallum sharing her story with Lara Webster. What an incredible woman. Now, that full story was on Landline. So if you want to watch back the episode or just other episodes of Landline you may have missed, you can head online or you can download the app, the ABC iView app, and you can watch all those ones back. It's time to check in on the markets, and Richard Thompson reports from the Gracemere Selling Centre.
Good afternoon, listeners. The yard yarding at CQLX Gracemere sale increased by 834 head to 2150, with cattle drawn from coastal areas around Mackay, Western Nebo and Theodore, and most local areas south to Mount Larkham. Quality and finish are again variable, with prices for steers similar to last sale based on quality. Heifers have shown improvement, again in part due to the quality yarded. Heavy finished cows have also improved by 20 cents a kilo on last sale rates. Yearling steers to restockers have sold to a top of 475 for the few offered. Growing steers and bullocks to processors made to 427 cents. The most suitable growing steers to feed average from 405 to 474 cents a kilo. Trade heifers topped at 429 and averaged 383 to 427 relative to the finish. Heavy four-score cows averaged 398 cents a kilo, and heavy bulls to processors averaged 376 for the few that were penned today. This has been Richard Thompson for the National Livestock Reporting Service of the MLA from Gracemere.
And the next one is the Dalby cattle sale, where David Friend has the details.
With scattered cows in the regular supply district, Dalby agents yarded 4,589 head, which included 660 head from far western Queensland. All the regular buyers attended, but not all operating in a stronger market. The market was solid at the time of this report. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos, selling from $3 to 484 cents a kilo to restockers. Yearling steers 334 kilos, sold from 386 to 484. Also to restockers, yearling steers 440 kilos, topping 486 to lot feeders. Yearling steers over 480 kilos to 454 cents to processors. Yearling heifers 280 to 330 kilos, topped at 454 to restockers. Growing steers 400 to 500 kilos, sold at 370. Growing steers 500 to 600 kilos to 445 cents to processors. A quality yarding of cows penned, sold at nearer market. The two score cows 400 to 520 kilos, 320 to 365 cents a kilo. The three score cows over 520 kilos to 420. Bulls over 600 kilos to 448 cents a kilo. They've been David Friend from National Ivory Sporting Service.
Over to the Charters Towers Selling Centre now with Mick Kingham.
Good afternoon. Isolated storms across most areas saw numbers reduced to 1,500 cattle in a prime-only sale. Despite a couple of good quality lines, quality was very mixed, comprising of fewer heavy bullocks, near 700 cows, and many smaller, lesser quality types. All regular buyers were present and operating at stronger rates throughout, with cattle drawn from Burkdown to Chiligo and south to the local area. Yearling steers and heifers to trade were up to 25 cents stronger, bullocks lifted 28, prime cows were firmed 12 cents higher, with heavyweight cows lifting up to 54. Yearling steers above 400 kilos to trade averaged 418, selling to 448. A good sample of yearling heifers above 400 kilos to trade made to 408 to average 392. Grown steers above 400 kilos to processors made to 406 to average 394. Heavy grown steers sold to 438. A reduced supply of heifers sold from 338 to 362. Isolated sales to 408 for some excellent heavy heifers. Heavy young bullocks to export slaughter topped at 450, most selling from 410 to 438. Medium weight two score cows to feed averaged 311. Processor types sold to 366 to average 322. Medium weight three score cows reached 386 to average 368. Prime heavyweight cows topped at 410. Most sales from 362 to 406. Heavy bulls to processors made to 358. This is Mick Kingham from Charters Towers, the National Livestock Reporting Service.
That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. My name's Megan Hughes. If you want to read any more about our stories, or if you want to listen back, you can head to the ABC Rural website, or you can search for the Queensland Country Hour online or on the ABC Listen app. News is up next. It is 1 o'clock.